Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of June. We're happy to have Richard Engel with us this hour. Richard's latest book is War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. He is the Middle East NBC news correspondent, and we've seen a lot of him over the last 5 years. He's actually more than that. He's lived in the Middle East for 12 years, and he is also author of A Fist in the Hornet's Nest. He has won many awards, the Alfred DuPont Columbia University Award, the Edward R. Murrow Award, an Emmy, and the Medill Medal for Courage in Journalism. He is the longest-serving broadcaster in Iraq and the only American television reporter to cover the country continuously before, during, and after the 2003 U.S. invasion. Important to his coverage is the fact that he is fluent in Arabic and has had access to U.S. military commanders, Sunni insurgents, Shiite militias, Iraqi families, and even the president, who has called him to the White House for a briefing. It is chock full of information about all that's going on. It gives you a really deep understanding of the background of why it is that we're having so many problems there right now. He's talked to many soldiers to ask them what motivations they have for fighting, if they do have some. And he's been a fabulously courageous reporter for a number of years. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Richard. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Emails are welcome, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Richard. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
You're entirely welcome.
You went over the top, but thank you. I'm embarrassed now for in front of all your listeners.
That's all right. I think you've gone over the top, so you deserve it. You know, I recall, I can't remember how long ago it was, not very long ago, when you were reporting from Iraq, and people, whoever was interviewing you on NBC was lamenting the fact that we're not getting enough news from Iraq, and you were saying, you were almost pleading with everybody, pay attention to what's going on here. Don't let it fall from the front story of the nightly news. This is still very important.
Well, I agree, and that is one of the great frustrations that I've been facing just over the last 6 months or so. I'm hopeful that now the domestic political situation is a little bit more settled. Mm. That, well, it's very unsettled, but at least it's clearer now that the Iraq war will become a major story once again.
Yeah.
It is a major story, and the issues are not resolved. You have a situation where violence has gone down very dramatically over the last, let's say, the last year, once the surge policy began. And the question is, where are we going to go from here? And I like to think of Iraq as not just one war. People always ask me, why are you in Iraq? Haven't you gotten tired of it? Don't you understand what's going over there? Couldn't you come back and report domestically? And I say, I've not covered one war in Iraq. There have been 5 distinct conflicts there. And each year has really been a different war, and that's what's kept it interesting, developing for me, and I think people at home have watched it, but might not necessarily have realized that they've been watching 5 different conflicts. The first one was, of course, the shooting war, the shock and awe when U.S. troops were rolling up from the south, from Kuwait, the left hook, into Baghdad. And I was in Baghdad at the time, and I was watching Saddam's government fall and talking to the Iraqi officials. If you remember the information minister who was famous for denying the fact that the war was even happening.
Yeah.
I used to interview him regularly. And until he and the rest of the government just disappeared and went off like smoke, as if they had never existed, and the country fell into looting and chaos. But it ushered in a second period, let's call it the second war, of nation building. And there was a period of calm, and some troops were welcomed into Baghdad with relatively open arms. I saw people on the streets of Baghdad walk up and give soldiers bottles of whiskey, and were Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds happy to be rid of Saddam Hussein. This period lasted roughly a year, and there was a period of nation building, constitution. There was talk of writing a new constitution, of holding elections, and these benchmarks did in fact happen. and elections were held, the Constitution was written, and the Constitution was one of the most liberal-minded, and I don't mean that in the sense that it's used in the States, in conservative versus liberal, I mean in the sense of one of the most non-traditional, in a Middle Eastern sense, constitutions that had been written. It was very open about women's rights. It had a Bill of Rights, and it was widely celebrated as one of the most progressive documents that had been passed in the region. But after this period of nation building, and there were quite a few mistakes that have been widely discussed, like the dissolving of the army, the country went into the next phase, War III. The insurgency. Mm. And a lot of people, particularly Sunnis, who felt that this march toward democracy was going to leave them isolated, they realized collectively that this was going to be a problem. The Shiites, who had been persecuted not directly by them but by the regime, were on the road to empowerment. And the military elite, particularly the Sunni elite within the military, felt betrayed and humiliated, and you had foreign fighters, people with an al-Qaeda-like ideology, people like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, came in and were able to capitalize on this militarily trained segment of society, a disgruntled population, and bring it together and create an insurgency. That would be the third war. And that insurgency targeted U.S. troops mm-hmm. and targeted Shiites, civilians, Shiite religious leaders, and that continued. It was a mostly one-sided fight until you go into the next phase, which was a civil war, when the two sides really start fighting back, and you have civilians killing civilians. And that continued and frightened Iraqis, and the country was at its worst stage probably in 2006 after the Samarra bombing. There was the destruction of the Golden Shrine. And now we're in a bit of a fifth phase, where extra troops came in. General Petraeus, the new commanding general, who's not so new anymore, but came in with a different plan, extra troops, formed alliances with the Sunni tribal leaders, and has now more Iraqi soldiers to help. And the violence has dropped off dramatically. The question we are, maybe 70%. You're not seeing. There was a time a year ago when there were 70 unidentified bodies found every day on the streets of Baghdad. Now I'm not driving by them like I did before. Their restaurants are opening up. People are going to school more, and there have been a lot of signs of encouraging signs. Mm-hmm. The question is, where do we go now? What's the sixth war? What's the exit strategy? And how quickly does that happen? Because Iraqis and everybody doesn't want it to go back to the way it was a year ago. But everyone also realizes, I think, including the military commanders I spoke to, that you can't sustain things at this level forever.
Right. You write about this, and tell me how this has changed over the years, your thoughts over the years. You write about Christmas Day of 2003 with a general asking soldiers to close their eyes and jump aboard this train of thought. I want to take you to that mall where your families are shopping. Guess what? Guess what that mall looks like to a terrorist who wants to go ahead and drive explosives into the mall. That's why you're there. You're over there not letting that terrorist have the opportunity to do that. You said the speech you had heard many times before bothered you as you listened to it again in 2007, and you kept thinking that the troops had been misled right from the beginning. How were they misled from the beginning, and how does it affect their morale, their reason, and their reasons for fighting there?
The rationale for the war, like there have been five different wars, there have been different rationales for the war, and they have changed over time. If you go back to the beginning, the first reason for going to war in Iraq was to overthrow Saddam Hussein, who allegedly had weapons of mass destruction and an alliance with however vague it may have been, with the people who were responsible for 9/11. That turned out not to be the case. Then there is a second reason for war that is provided. Once the troops are already in Iraq, no weapons of mass destruction are found, the rationale is given, we're here to bring democracy to the people of Iraq and help them write a constitution and build their institution and build a new nation. And that did happen. But elections were held, but the country then collapsed into an insurgency and then later into a civil war. So that's problematic. The third rationale was one of the people fighting in that civil war and in the insurgency was a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So the logic became, well, we're fighting Al-Qaeda, and this is what we've always been doing. Go back to reason one, retroactive logic, it's the same that we've been doing right now. That has also been proven to be difficult because right now the soldiers aren't fighting Al-Qaeda anymore. The tribal leaders have basically pushed Al-Qaeda militants into the background.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that we're given right now is if we don't continue the war in Iraq, the whole region will collapse into chaos and Iran will take over. Now, of all the rationales, that one seems to be the most closely related to the truth that, according to the people I speak to on the ground, of all of them. But it is a difficult situation to be in because you're basically faced with a situation where you're there, but if you pull out, it'll get worse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does it affect the troops' morale? Generally, on a unit level, the troops' morale has always been good. They can rely on their families, on their faith, on their commitment to patriotism to get them through. But their enthusiasm, let's say, toward the mission has been going up and down. In 2005 and 2006, a lot of soldiers were leaving and then coming back to a country on a second or third rotation and finding it worse than when they left, and that's very discouraging. Now, they are coming back to a country, I mean, right now, and finding it better. And they're going and doing clearing operations in neighborhoods, and they're making arrests, and they're finding out that these neighborhoods will then, by and large, stay safe after they're leaving. And it's not like slapping water, where as soon as they pull out, the situation just gets chaotic again. And that's very encouraging. And I've seen soldiers getting the thumbs up again on the street for the first time in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Baghdad, I just came out from Baghdad about a week ago. The question is, how long can this be sustained? And it's also very difficult on their family lives. The soldiers are now going through rotation after rotation with very little downtime in between, which means that family problems don't necessarily get resolved. They'll come back, they'll spend a little bit of time with their families, with their children, and the next thing they know, they're preparing for the next deployment.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that 80% of the soldiers that you talk about are like this, they don't care about the mission or really understand it, but they're there to protect the guy on the left and the guy on the right, and that number has grown. Is it still 80%, or is there beginning to be more belief in the mission?
It fluctuates.
I see.
And by and large, the average soldier driving a Humvee, he's there to protect his unit. He's there to protect his men. They are also they believe that they're doing a patriotic duty, that they are serving the nation and they are serving what the nation has asked them to do. Going back, many of these soldiers or many soldiers joined the army after 9/11. They felt that this was an obligation that they wanted to fulfill to protect the United States against another terrorist attack. Over time, as it became more of an Iraqi-on-Iraqi fight or a proxy war with Iran, and as the connections to 9/11, which were always sort of tenuous, have proved to be even more tenuous based on intelligence estimates, that connection has become more and more difficult for them to defend and difficult for them to be to believe in. Many of them still do. If you ask a lot of soldiers, they will tell you that they believe they are fighting in Iraq to fight terrorists there, and so that they don't have to fight them in the shopping malls and places like that in the United States. But I think overall, most of them are there because they have a sense of patriotism and because they have a sense that they are there to protect their unit and their guys. They don't like to be at home back in garrison when they know their unit and the people that they've trained with and their family friends and their wives' friends are off deployed and that they're not pulling up their end of the slack.
Yeah. Richard, tell me the story of how in the world you ever got there. And you're fluent in Arabic, I understand. How did this happen?
it's an interesting story. I think it's a bit of an un, indirect path. I moved to Cairo. People ask me all the time, young people, young journalists, and I'm pretty young myself, but even younger journalists ask me, well, how do you become a foreign correspondent? And the answer is just do it. You just have to go there and do it yourself. No one will make you a foreign correspondent and give you that job. You have to just go, in my opinion. And after I graduated from school, I took about $2,000 and moved to Cairo. This was in 1996. I thought the Middle East was going to be the story of the next generation, of my generation of reporters, and moved in a poor neighborhood and started learning the language and started freelance reporting and learned the culture, learned the way to get around in the city, and I was there for ultimately 4 years. And the people were very friendly to me. The Egyptian authorities found this a bit unusual, that here was this American kid learning Arabic, speaking Arabic, living in a slum, and they kept arresting me, and I was accused of being the CIA station chief at 24.
Oh, my.
And there was headlines about me in the newspaper that I'd been arrested and thrown out of the country. And it was an interesting time. They used to follow me around, tap my phones, and they were not very discreet about it. I mean, we're talking Egyptian authorities in black leather trench coats on a sunny day, reading newspapers, standing on corners. And when they would tap my phone, sometimes they would do it so badly I could hear the spoons clinking in their teacups as they were drinking tea and coughing from all the cigarettes they would smoke while they were listening to me and probably every other person, every other foreigner in Egypt. But they were never, you know, unfriendly, and it was just kind of they like to keep track of people. Then I lived in, based in Jerusalem, and because I spoke Arabic, I spent the next 3 years covering the West Bank and Gaza Strip as the Intifada, the second Intifada, the Al-Aqsa Intifada, was going on. And then in 2002, early first few weeks of 2003, it was clear that the war in Iraq was going to happen, and that this would be the conflict that I had gone to the Middle East to see, the one that was going to be a game changer. And I fundamentally believe the Middle East is going through a historic transformation period. So I had a similar approach. I took more money this time, about $20,000, and just went into Baghdad, bought a visa. At the time, there was a thing called a human shield visa, and the Saddam government was giving out, extended this invitation to foreigners, particularly Americans, if they wanted to go to Iraq before the invasion and strap themselves to a power plant and say, don't bomb, I'm here.
Oh, my gosh.
And I took one of those.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I never strapped myself to a power plant. What I did is I took the visa, thank you very much, got into Baghdad, and then disappeared into the concrete jungle and was staying in people's homes, in different hotels. I had hotels registered under different names and was just moving around trying to be as anonymous as possible in the very nervous, nerve-wracking period leading up to the invasion.
Let's pause for a moment and start welcoming phone calls. Richard Engel is our guest. His book is War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. He has lived in the Middle East for 12 years. He's the NBC News Middle East correspondent there. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, which at least one of you has done so far, go ahead, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard Engel is our guest. His book is War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. And we start our call with Bob from Darlington. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Richard, why do you think that, and not just in Iraq, but all over the Muslim world, it's so difficult for Sunnis and Shia to get along?
I actually think it's not that difficult for them to get along. And many Iraqi families, Sunnis and Shiites, were intermarried. And at one stage, and that was why it was so brutal in Iraq, we're not talking about house-to-house fighting at its worst stage in 2006. It was room-to-room fighting because it was driving families apart. And there were cases where Sunnis and Shiites, because of pressure from their extended families, were divorcing each other because it was just considered insensitive situation, and so they were separating. Now, Sunnis and Shiites have gotten along for centuries in the region, but because of what we might consider a regional dynamic, I think that's what's driving a lot of it. Across the Middle East, there's something of a Cold War dynamic that is developed as a result of the war in Iraq and other policies, where you have Shiite Persia, Shiite Iran, vying for dominance over the region versus other Sunni Arab states like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and that fault line runs right through Iraq. So it is this regional tension that has probably been unleashed with the collapse of Iraq and now the rebuilding of a state in the center of the Middle East that is, I think, inflaming these tensions that were not very existent on a personal level. So if you have the whole region upset and the whole region trying to find a new balance, I think that's what's causing a lot of the tension within Iraq. But in other countries, you have Sunnis and Shiites that get along very well.
You also have a really clear-to-read understanding of the history involved here, too, which I found fascinating.
Thank you. I think it's a very important history. People don't necessarily realize that this is not just a conflict in Iraq. It is the Kurds are fighting for their own sense of a national homeland, Kurdistan, which they've been denied at least since World War I, but many Kurds believe a lot longer than that. Then you have a Shiite community that feels empowered for the first time since the creation of Shia Islam, which was created in Iraq, in Najaf, in the Najaf area. And they feel that this is at the end of a long road of martyrdom. They are finally feeling some sort of redemption and claiming power in their holy land. And the Sunnis also feel that this is an important historical struggle, that if they don't stake their claims right now, that they're going to be driven off the map by Iran and by the Iraqi Shiites. So it is important to understand that it is not just a simple war of moderates or people who are pro-democracy and against democracy, but each group has its own historical basis for the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Anything more, Bob?
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like Christendom in some ways, like, the battle in the 18 and 1900s between, let's say, Lutherans and Catholics. But yet they got along better than the Arabs. You know, eventually they intermarried and they kind of settled and compromised. And now it seems like that is kind of like the Black Crusade to get civil rights. I think both those issues are somewhat comparable in some ways, but everything is kind of settling down in both areas now, finally. So this Arab thing sounds somewhat like that in some ways, but like Richard says, it's very complicated and it goes back for centuries.
But it's more of a power struggle, I believe, than a religious struggle. You see Iran, a Shiite Persian state, vying for dominance of particularly the Persian Gulf. Iran wants to make the Persian Gulf the Persian Gulf, and the Arab states, which are very nervous about that and don't want that to happen, and are arming themselves. There is an arms race going on with the Arab countries buying a lot of weapons, which are being pointed now in the direction of Iran. And this tension between Sunnis and Shiites on a regional level, as I was saying earlier, I think is what's infiltrating and upsetting a delicate balance. There had been tensions within Iraq, but nothing like the scale that we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bob, for the call. Let's go to an email here. Would you ask you if all this was possible in part due to the general American ignorance of the Middle East and its peoples? I felt so exasperated with this, as I've had many friends from Arab countries as a student. What do you see as the average Iraqi's attitude toward the occupation and to the Maliki government, which some see as an American puppet?
The Iraqi people, as one could probably imagine, have very conflicted emotions about what's happened to them. And when Saddam's regime was first toppled, Iraqis were happy that this was gone. Saddam's regime was appalling. And there is a sense that a common myth that Sunnis under Saddam lived well and somehow lorded it over the rest of the population. They had a degree of a privileged status, but most of them lived just as badly as anyone else. And so I think at first there was a honeymoon period, and Iraqis were very happy to see the Americans there. Then, as the situation descended into chaos, that feeling switched to resentment at what had happened to them. Why have you done this? You've unleashed all of these tensions that we're very afraid of, meaning the Sunni-Shiite conflict. Now, as things are getting better recently, there is a little a renewed sense of hope, but also a feeling of dependency, because Iraqis don't want the U.S. troops to pull back and allow them to fall back into anarchy again. So it went from love, if you will, to hate, to dependency, and all of that accounts for a very complicated relationship.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob, so much for the call. Let us go next to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Salam alaikum, Richard.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Wow.
a couple of comments and a question. First of all, thank you for your service, because that's what you've been doing there. And hopefully, whoever's going to be the next president will have access to you so they can gain some insight as to what's actually going on over there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The good thing that I have is I'm working in a public venue, so I do get a chance like this conversation that we're having. To talk about events, and I hope it is a constantly evolving process. It's hard to pin down and say what it's been like, because it has changed over time.
I agree. I hope they have the intelligence to listen to you. Now, my question or my comment is the following. I don't think we can identify this as just Iraq, because I think this is more a regional type problem. And whatever the reasons that, you know, for which we got in and the incredible mismanagement of the war were there. And the important thing now, it seems to me, is the end game. In other words, not so much how do we get out, but how do we
manage the situation that we're in.
Yes. How do we keep our thumb on what, unfortunately, and we have to face reality, is, you know, 80% of the world's oil reserves are there. And
well, that's the sixth war that we're in right now, the exit strategy. Right now there are 150,000 troops, give or take, in Iraq. And the plan, according to General Petraeus, is for about 10,000 of those to come out this summer, 10,000 more. And then he's asked for a pause to reevaluate. And think of it like taking little weights off of a scale. So you take a few off and then you see what happens. And then one would assume if things are stable, they will take some more out. And I think the debate that's going on in the United States, and the one that the next administration is going to have to face, is the pace of events. Do you decline rapidly? Do you go slowly? Because you don't want that scale to tip, because I think there is a universal understanding that there's not going to be another surge. You're not going to send another large contingency of forces in there to stabilize things once again. And it is going to be a difficult balance, and you have states like Iran and Saudi Arabia all influencing that debate.
Thank you so much for your call. 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Tell us the story, Richard, because these people are so important to you and to other journalists, the people who really know the country, the Iraqis, and who are there to get you soups that will cure your fever and to get you interviews with
yes, I've worked very
all kinds of people.
With some very brave Iraqi local staff at our bureau who have risked a tremendous amount, and some of them have suffered a tremendous amount to tell the story of their country at great personal risk and sacrifice to themselves. Ali, for example, is a person who's featured in the book and who has been a close friend of mine for years now. I just spoke with him yesterday, and he was a young man, still is, a student when I first arrived in Iraq, and was my driver during the invasion phase, and he would be the guy who kept me, helped keep me hidden and would bring me food. And he is, his father was kidnapped and is presumed to have been killed. Ali went on a search for him, looking for his body, and never found it. Then Ali himself was kidnapped and was tortured, and then he saved most of his money and paid a human smuggler without even telling anybody that he was going, and moved to Sweden. And he's now sitting in Sweden trying to get refugee status and political asylum. Like many, there are about 4 million Iraqi refugees or internally displaced people in the country, and that is one of the lingering problems that that country and the entire region and, to a degree, the entire world is facing.
Let's go to Bill from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for the program. This question may seem a bit cynical, but it seemed to me that at least late summer, early fall of 2002, that in spite of whatever happened, we were going to go to war in Iraq. And I was wondering, maybe when you had that, perhaps if you did have that same realization before, you know, let's say March of 2003, and if you did have that realization, what was it?
It became pretty clear in the weeks and months leading up to the invasion that the war was happening. The troops were already on the move, and the troops were building up. First, there was going to be a talk of a land invasion from Turkey. Then Turkey didn't agree to that, so everything shifted to the south. And I think right until the end, it was fairly obvious that it was going to happen, but it wasn't sure. And I don't think Saddam Hussein fully realized that it was in fact going to happen right until the end. Talking to Iraqi government officials, I think they thought perhaps it would be another series of airstrikes and that it was a bit of saber rattling. And then once there was a bit of surprise when the troops actually crossed the threshold, I thought it would happen. That's why I went to Iraq.
Anything else?
No,
that's it, Bill. All right, thanks so much for your call. We have an email here. How did Engel develop an interest in foreign cultures, and what pathway exists to encourage this career, Richard?
I've always wanted to be a foreign correspondent for quite a bit of time. I think I developed it. An interest in foreign cultures when I was very young. I was lucky enough. I opened the window. I think I'm going to close the window. It's a little bit noisy outside. I developed this when I was in high school. I went on a study abroad program when I was 16 to Italy. And it was a wonderful program, the AFS, the American Field Service. Mm-hmm. And it is a classic junior year abroad. And I'm from New York originally, which is by definition a very international city. But this was the first time that I had a real experience living in a foreign culture, living in a family as I was, learning Italian, and it was an incredible personal experience for me. It was the first time I could see my own life in my own country as an outsider would see it. And I caught the bug as soon as I graduated from college, and then I moved back again, not to Italy this time, but to the Middle East. But I think it started at a very young age, and people, it is a wonderful program. If people have children and they want to give them an international experience, this was great. I can't speak highly enough of the program.
Yeah. Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I wanted to ask your guest about our private military that we have there, Forces for Profit, and if you've written about that, and how do the people in Iraq feel about forces there that are there for profit and not as the government military?
There are many private security contractors in the country, and generally they're not popular. These would be, a lot of people have written about Blackwater USA, which had a very public incident where some Iraqi civilians were killed, 17 in one incident, and that created a lot of animosity toward this group. In general, I think they are viewed with great skepticism also by the Iraqi government, which is nervous about having these private armed groups driving around the country, operating in a situation where they have had very few restrictions on their rules of engagement. What they do is necessary, and for when traveling around the country, there are certain jobs that the military, that if the security contractors weren't doing it, then you'd have to have men in uniform doing it. So when you're driving convoys across up from Kuwait, if you didn't have private security contractors protecting the convoys that are bringing in supply and cappuccino powder for the embassy, you would have soldiers doing that. So I think to a degree there is a role for a private security contingency, but they have operated at times in Baghdad with very little control and alienated large segments of society. And it is something that the Iraqi government and the U.S. are now trying to regulate. There has been a lot of discussion recently about a long-term pact between the U.S. and Iraq, a long-term strategic agreement to try and establish some of the rules and the framework under which U.S. forces and private American contractors will be able to operate in Iraq. And there is great debate over that. The U.S. wants these people to be able to operate free from prosecution and to be able to move independently, and the Iraqi government is trying to put restrictions on that. And it is still very much an open debate. That agreement is supposed to be finished by July. There are increasing indications that it might not get done in time.
Mm. Thank you so much for the call. Mary from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
I am actually trying to locate the book right now, but it was a couple of years ago I read in a book, and I'm sorry I can't give you the title of it, that the schism between the Sunni and the Shiite was the fact that I believe it was the Sunnis who believed that Muhammad was the last prophet, and the Shiites who believed that there was a subsequent prophet to Muhammad, and that's where the schism.
It goes back to when Muhammad died, he had created an empire, an Islamic state in which he was not only the prophet of Islam, but he was also the ruler of an Islamic empire based in the Hejaz, in the Mecca Medina area of Saudi Arabia. When he died, there was a question, who would continue to guide the empire on a spiritual level, and who would continue to be its ruler. And there was an immediate problem after he died because there was no clear leader. He didn't have any sons. And after great debate, some people thought that it should have gone to his closest male relative, Ali, who was very young at the time. Others thought it should have gone to Muhammad's closest confidant, Abu Bakr. It eventually went to Abu Bakr. Ali later on did assume control and was then killed. When he was killed, people initially who always supported his rule and his family line backed him, and others who supported the way that power had been passed on supported that, and they became more of the traditionalists. And that divide is what fundamentally became the divide between Sunnis and Shiites. The Sunnis supporting the traditional progression of power, and the supporters of Ali backing his claim for power. And the partisans of Ali, the Shi'at Ali, as the Shiites became to be known, continue to this day. They are still the minority in the Islamic world, but do form the majority in Iraq.
That's what I've read. Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Mary, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. More phone calls in a moment. Richard Engel is our guest this hour. His book is War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. He is the NBC News Middle East correspondent. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Richard Engel, our guest this hour, War Journal is his book, My 5 Years in Iraq, just published by Simon & Schuster. And we go next to Othman from Milwaukee. Hi, Othman.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
And I want to thank Richard Engel as well. Two quick questions, just to get your opinion. The way we set up this government in Iraq seems to be kind of on sectarian lines, and I just want to know, are we setting up some kind of new Lebanon where we're going to have problems, you know, 40, 50 years down the line? That's the first question, just your thoughts on that. Second, both candidates for president are talking a lot about Iran and the threat of Iran, and you indicated that there's some conflict, obviously, between the different countries. Do you see it as a conflict between countries, for example, some of these, the Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and others, or is it a grassroots fear of Iran? In other words, is it the dictatorial leaders who are afraid of something that Iran represents, or something different? Just your thoughts.
Great questions. There are many parallels to Lebanon, and there is a concern that the long-term Lebanon is a country that is deeply divided between, there are 18 different political and religious factions in the country, many of which are armed. You have Sunnis and Shiites and Christians and Palestinians and the Druze. And Lebanon is a country even more divided along sectarian and ethnic lines than Iraq is. And it has been one that has been tremendously problematic. It had its own 15-year civil war. It now had just a few weeks ago, I live in Beirut when I'm not in Baghdad, and it just recently had another period of tremendous upheaval. And the Lebanon model is one that is very frightening for Iraq if you make a comparison. Lebanon has a very small population, only about 4 million people, and in their 15-year civil war, you had 150,000 people killed. So if you did that model, if you transposed one onto Iraq and multiply by the population, there are about 25, 26 million people in Iraq, you could have a situation where you have hundreds of thousands dead over time in Iraq. So there is a concern that unless you solve the issues in Iraq in a reasonable way, you could have a new Lebanon where over decades you have periods of intense ethnic fighting. The goal that they're trying to set up in Iraq, and this is something most all parties agree on, is a federal system. In Lebanon, they developed a power-sharing agreement in which each group was guaranteed a role in government. The Christians were given certain posts in the government, the Sunnis the same, the Shiites the same. And that system has proven to be fairly unstable. What they're trying to do in Iraq is a slightly different model. It is a federal system where you have a central government in Baghdad that rules over a different provinces and rules over different federal regions. The problem is, and this is one of the great debates in Iraq, is how much power do the regions have? Does Kurdistan, the Kurdish regions in the north, have the ability to break away? Does it have control over its own oil resources? Who distributes the oil wealth within the country? And it's the same debate that Americans faced in the states' rights versus national supremacy debate that lasted still part of the national discourse. If that debate is solved, you could have a situation where Iraq is more stable than Lebanon, but it is unclear how the issues are going to be resolved. These are real issues where you have the Shiite federal regions in the south. Do they have the right to form alliances with each other? Do they have a right to extract their own oil and sell it directly to Iran? Does it all have to be channeled through the central government? But these are open questions. On your other question, is the fear of Iran on a grassroots level, or is it just from the Sunni states? In Iraq, it's both. This Iraq fought Iran in a war, and there are many people on the ground who are just generally nervous about Iran. They were told for years that it was the enemy, and they don't want to see Iran come in and take over. This is also Iraqi Shiites. Iraqi Shiites do not want to be dominated by Iran. And if you ask people on the ground in Iraq about Iran, there is a gut reaction. People will tell you they're very nervous about it. And almost any problem nowadays in Iraq is immediately blamed on Iran. So there is a built-in conspiracy theory on the ground to have an antagonism toward Iran. So it is something, at least in Iraq, that is also present on a popular level. In countries that are a little bit more distant, like Egypt, I'm not so sure they're very concerned about Iran. It is someplace far off, but they don't want to see it dominating the Middle East. So, to answer your question, it is something that is shared by the governments, but also present on a popular level, depending on the proximity to Iran.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Othman, for your call. Let's go next to Richard. From where are you from?
I'm from Brookfield.
Oh, you're from Brookfield. All right, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Mr. Engel. I'd like to ask you two questions. We hear from our country's leadership that we can't leave until we've achieved victory. And I would like to know what you think the definition of victory is in Iraq. And secondarily, based on that definition, what you think the likelihood is of us achieving that state in the foreseeable future. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Richard.
I think victory in Iraq would be a country that is stable, that is not a threat to itself or to its neighbors, that is economically prosperous, where oil is flowing out of the country, flowing to the world markets, where money is flowing back into the people of Iraq's pockets. And over time, I think it is possible. There are some things that are very... Iraq has a few natural advantages that help it. It is a small, relatively small population, about 25, 26 million, a highly educated population, a country that was an industrial power, and it has tremendous oil reserves. The Iraqi government recently claimed that Iraq's oil reserves are greater than the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia. All of these things do add up or could add up to a successful country. It has gone through five tumultuous years and probably has several more tumultuous years to go. If the country can prevent itself from descending into a Lebanon, a fundamentally failed state where the different power sharing, where the power balance of power was never adequately defined, then it'll be a real problem. Then they won't get to a position where they can take advantage of the country's natural resources and natural advantages. We are in a situation where to achieve victory or to achieve success, you have to manage chaos. And that's going back to what we were talking about earlier. That's, I think, something that is going to be facing the next leadership, both in the military and the political leadership of this country. How quickly do you draw down the forces, and at what level of risk are you willing to assume? If you immediately pulled out all the troops tomorrow, things would turn into chaos. And I think that's universally accepted by Iraqis, by the U.S. military, that if suddenly there was a decision to flip the switch, pull them all out, a lot of the gains that have been achieved in the last year would be erased. But you can't simultaneously keep them there forever. So it's managing the drawdown. How quickly is that going to go? And if it is managed effectively, yes, there is a chance that Iraq could be a successful state.
How long are you going to stay there, Richard?
I'm now still a foreign correspondent at Middle East, covering the Middle East, but also covering a bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm continuing to be covering Iraq. I don't know if I'm going to be living there full time like I have been for the past 5 years. And already I've been doing other stories. I spent a couple of months in Pakistan. I've been to Afghanistan recently, and I'm trying to spread out the coverage. But if you cover foreign news like I do, and you're serious about covering foreign news, you cannot ignore the Iraq story. It will continue to be, if not the dominant story in foreign news, at least one of the dominant stories. So I think going forward over the next year or two, it will continue to take up probably the majority of my time.
Mm-hmm. Ed from Nina, hi. We're almost out of time, Ed.
Yes, quickly, you described a very complex situation, one that you just used the word chaotic. My question is, how much of the mismanagement that we hear about in our country is almost to be expected in such a situation, and how much of it is really culpable mismanagement?
That's a lot of people look back and they say everything had to do with the Bremer administration. It was all mistakes that were made in 2004, and it was a total disaster, and it could have been perfect. I'm not sure about that, frankly. I think there were many mistakes that were made, and things could have gone a lot better had those mistakes not been made. But it is a tremendously chaotic situation, and I'm not sure if anyone could have managed it smoothly. Let me give you an example.
Very quickly. We're almost out of time, Richard.
When people talk about the fall of Baghdad, and were there enough troops on the ground to stabilize it, as an example, I was watching Baghdad fall and watching some of the looting. You would have needed many, many, many more troops in order to try and stabilize it. Because I was standing next to soldiers who were watching buildings being looted, and they were sitting in tanks. And the soldiers looked at me and said, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to start opening fire? Do we arrest people?
And on that note, we have to end with those questions. Richard Engel, thank you so much. Thanks for the book. The book is War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and John Anderson for producing the program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.